We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for this program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. Over the past 4 months or so, a wave of popular protest has swept through North Africa and the Middle East. Demonstrators have toppled regimes in Tunisia and Egypt and have challenged others in a number of countries, among them Algeria, Yemen, Bahrain, Syria. In this hour, we'll try to talk a little bit about how and why ordinary people in so many places managed to take ownership of the political space, a space that had been so tightly controlled by authoritarian governments. And our guest is Asif Bayat. He's a professor of sociology and Middle East studies here at the University of Illinois and has written a lot about social movements in the Middle East. He taught sociology and Middle East studies at the American University in Cairo for 16 years and then moved on to Leiden University in the Netherlands. He's also had visiting positions at UC Berkeley, at Columbia, New York, and University of Oxford, and has authored a number of books, including Life as Politics, How Ordinary People Change the Middle East. Stanford is the publisher. He's just fairly recently been in Egypt, so we can talk a little bit about that and overall try to get a better understanding of what is going on and these various countries in this region where there has been a great deal of political activity. And questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can email your questions, comments to will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much for being here again.
And thank you for having me.
Well, the last time you were here with Professor Kuno, Ken
yes.
Kuno, and it was, I think it was the day before Hosni Mubarak stepped down. So we were talking about that and what might happen. Now, particularly because of other sorts of things in the region, Libya being the one, I think we haven't really heard very much about Egypt now, really, since that happened. Perhaps you might just talk a little, having just been in Egypt, talk a little bit about what's the atmosphere now in Egypt.
Yes. Well, I just came back a couple of days ago from Egypt, and I couldn't really stay away being there. And while I was there, of course, I had a number of conversations with a number of actors, especially, you know, the activists and whether Islamists and liberals and or basically civil activists in Egyptian society. And on the one hand, there is this sense that there is this incredible optimism, you know, for the future, that there is a feeling that they have managed, after so many years, bring down this long-standing president who, like many other leaders in the region, thought that he owned the nation. So they have brought him down. The fact that a dictator has disappeared has opened up a lot of opportunity, a lot of spaces for a lot of people to be active in society, which in the past they didn't have that opportunity. So it's incredible energy on the part of the civil society. This is on the one hand, but on the other hand, then there is also an anxiety about the future. First of all, economically, things are not good because there has been a revolution and a lot of businesses, you know, have been not really operating, especially tourism. But tourism has just started. So there is this anxiety over there. But most of all, however, is about the sort of form of the future government. Because this is a revolution that has taken place and has incredible social power, but right now it is not running the place. You see, the revolutionaries are not running the place. They don't have administrative authority. Somebody else, an institution of incumbent regime, that is the military, actually running the place. but it is claiming that it is doing so on behalf of the revolution. But in fact, there are a lot of disagreements between the revolutionaries on the one hand and the military authorities in Egypt. So yeah. These are the sort of general, we can go into detail later.
Well, it seems that I made the point, and I think it's really important, that as you look at what's happened in this region, you consider that every country is an individual situation.
Right.
The what applies there is different. And one of the – it seems to me that one of the big things that you have to acknowledge in Egypt was that the military decided that it was time for Mr. Mubarak to go.
Yes.
And so, you know, you ask the question, well, whose interests are being served here, and what are the interests of the military? And it seems to be the case that the interests of the military are the interests of the military.
You know? Right.
So, people question what had happened here, whether was this a revolution? Was this, in fact, a military coup?
Yes,
and what happens next?
Yes, yes. I think it was a revolution. I mean, a revolution in the sense that you had this nationwide, widespread popular revolt that came from below, and which is that differentiates it from a change from above, which is coup, by segments of the regime against another segment of the regime. No. So it is not like this. It was a popular revolt from below that compelled the military to step in order to perhaps to save the nation and to save itself, push President Mubarak to actually step down. And, of course, military remains, by and large, intact. So in that sense, it is a revolution. But what is, however, a discussion right now in Egypt is to what extent the revolution has been able to move into the status structure, to change the institutions of the incumbent regime, to change the top officials, the personnel. And a lot of them right now still are there. I mean, the very top ones, 7 or 8 of them, are now in the house arrest, or they are going to be tried by the military. But nevertheless, the actual, I think, institutions of the state remain intact. Of course, the military is saying that, well, we cannot change this overnight. There is a plan to have a new elections for the parliament and the president, and, of course, a ratification of a new constitution. Mm-hmm. So it is a time of somewhat uncertainty, and that is something that really makes ordinary people, those people who maybe not follow the news very well, quite anxious about their future.
To just stay with Egypt for a moment, you're interested in what people, the kinds of things that people do in their daily
right.
lives that start to create the conditions for the kind of things that we have seen. So
right.
you've said, you know, yeah, you need to look back before you have enormous numbers of people turning out in the streets.
Correct.
What are people doing as individuals
right.
to that makes that kind of thing possible?
Yes, yes. Let me just mention that, I mean, the purpose of this book, Life as Politics, was in some way to first of all, respond to a major claim, especially in the West, about mm-hmm. the basically political stagnation in the Middle East. The idea that these regimes are there because people don't do much. They are passive. Mm. And perhaps this has to do with their culture, even to some extent it has to do with the Islam that advocates for sabr or patience and things like this. These kind of claims have been made. Mm-hmm. But living there for a long time, I could notice that this is not really the case. There are a lot of activities on the part of the very ordinary people, and by which I mean the urban poor, those people who live in the shanty towns, or Muslim women, or youth, basically, on a daily basis. On a daily basis, actually, they make their claims. For instance, the shantytown dwellers, they are the ones who migrated from the countryside in search of jobs. They don't remain there and wait for, you know, their fate to determine their lives, but actually they do something. They move on, they come to the cities, and they try to get a plot of land. Sometimes they occupy it illegally in certain areas, and they establish their shelter. Then after a while, they get their electricity, their water, and gradually they establish communities. Just imagine that hundreds of thousands of people are doing so. And in this way, in fact, they are transforming the cities and creating communities for themselves when they realize that the state actually doesn't do for them. In the same fashion, you know, Muslim women who they feel that they have been unacceptable gender inequality in their societies, they fight on a daily basis for for equality. They do want to be publicly active. They want to study in the universities. They do want to work outside. And they also want equality in, you know, personal status, in initiating divorce or choice of marriage partner and so on and so forth. And they do this, you know, on a daily basis. Maybe they are not. They were not doing it, you know, collectively, because there was an opportunity for them to collectively get together because it was banned by the authorities. But they have been doing individually. Now, when again hundreds of thousands of women do on kind of daily basis, perhaps individually, but they do something which is common, something which is similar. In the long run, they establish new sort of norm in society, new values in society that compels the authorities to actually acknowledge that. I can say the same thing about the youth, to express their youthfulness while they are being sort of in some way suppressed, in my view, by the religious authority, moral authority, by parents, by social pressure, and so forth. They are also want to express their youthfulness as individual sort of agents who have certain demands, desires, and claims in society, and they do so also not necessarily collectively as a movement, because again they don't have the opportunity to do it because politically. It is not acceptable on the part of the authorities. So they have been doing it, through what I called movements. That is collective action of non-collective actors. Yeah. Mm. But in the long run, they have brought about significant changes. Now, when the opportunity came, in the 25th of January last year, so these people. These ordinary people were already in the process of mobilization. Although they were individual, now there was an opportunity for them to collectively get together and come to Maidan Tahrir or the Tahrir Square. And then they see each other, that they are huge collective, that they are huge sort of social actors. And that gave them a new sort of power, a new vision in about how they can change things, and mm-hmm. they did it.
Yeah. See, this is very interesting because it definitely underscores some points that we made in another recent conversation. I talked with a journalist named Doug Saunders, mm-hmm. who wrote this book titled Arrival City.
Right.
And this is a process of a lot of reporting that he did, going to various places around the world. Oh, you.
I know. He's interviewed me a few times. Okay. Yeah. He's in Canada, right?
Yes. He's a Canadian journalist. Okay. And has gone to different places where he's looking at the same trend, people right. moving from the village to the city right. with the hope that then they can have a better life and their family will rise.
Right.
He indeed made the point that a lot of the people who were involved in what happened in Egypt were people were these kinds of people. And he also goes on to make this point. He says that how governments try to manage the expectations of these people and whether they either try to crush them
yes.
or try to provide avenues for them to realize those expectations, how you manage this trend. He says this is very important and can certainly be very can influence the politics of entire countries.
Absolutely.
And here, this is a perfect example of that very thing.
Exactly. I think one of the interesting things about the Arab states have been that they have been authoritarian but developmentalist. So they have been sort of taking the charge of, developing their nations. Of course, these are typical kind of post-colonial scenarios that most of these governments have been nationalistic, and after the colonialism, they wanted to build their nations. So they have been taking the charge of, development plans and so forth. Of course, this so-called neoliberal restructuring or economic policies is somewhat recent, the product of the, early 1990s, which has a different consequence. But anyway, so one of the consequences of those development plans have been really considerable urbanization. And so that, some people think that, in fact, urban development has been at the cost of, rural people. So there has been this duality. But anyway, when you move into city and you become literally citizens, the inhabitants of a city, that the citizenship, that is, being inhabited in the city, gives you or inculcates in you a particular claims, desire, and demands. Very often those very regimes themselves are unable to fulfill. For instance, a person who lives in a village might not have electricity, right? Might not have necessary running water, and he might not, or she might not, demand, they fetch water from the well and so forth. This is what myself have been doing when I was growing up in the village. Mm-hmm. But when we moved to the city, then we took it for granted that there must be running water, there must be electricity, right? And there must be paved road. These are sort of new demands and claims that or urban services that basically people take for granted as their rights. Now, if you see that millions of people moving into city and creating the communities and making these demands, this is a huge demand. This is a huge claim on the part of the authorities, urban authorities, and the states must respond to them. If they don't, that these people feel that they are excluded, that they have been marginalized, and that generates discontent on their part. So there have been, urban riots, and many times, in fact, in the region, for these kinds of claims. And of course, these claims merge in some way into the political demand of removing the dictator, because by and large, they saw that these inadequacies and these deficits had a lot to do with the kind of authoritarian rule that people like Mubarak had established.
Yeah. Well, if you were this kind of government, would one lesson that you could take from that, though, be that if you can meet people's economic expectations,
right,
and give them electricity and running water and roads, make it possible for them to work their way up, have a better life for their children than they had, that maybe they won't be quite as so demanding when it comes to political freedom, freedom of speech, free elections, and so forth, and that if you could satisfy the one needs, maybe you don't have to worry as much about the other.
Well, one would expect so. One would expect so. I think these are sort of primary needs that the people need to be fulfilled. But once they have, then there are other needs that they feel should be respected. Especially, just remember that these people now are becoming more and more educated. Even the inhabitants of the so-called ashwaiyat or haphazard or popular neighborhoods, which, for instance, in the case of Cairo, constitute about half of the population, of the huge city, they are becoming educated. So you go in the informal communities, you see lawyers, offices, and teachers, and government employees, and white-collar workers. Why they are pushed to live in those neighborhoods. Now, these people, of course, they do want their water, their electricity, and their paved road, but they also want something else. They want also their dignity to be respected. I mean, I think the example for this in the Persian Gulf states in places like in Bahrain or in Kuwait or in Saudi Arabia, for instance. Of course, for a long time, the sheikhdoms and the kingdoms here have been tried to buy off, I mean, literally buy off the opposition. Recently, King Abdullah goes to on television and literally thanks. He says, "Thank you, my people, for not doing revolution." and then immediately there is cash, sort of distributed among people in some way, to buy off the opposition. But I think that buying off the opposition through economic means, I think, is important and it works for some time. But not for a long time. So people begin to demand beyond that, political participation. And therefore, I don't think that in the long run, those rich regimes necessarily are immune from, popular discontent for, political reform and more openness.
Mm. Our guest in this hour, Asif Bayat. He is professor of sociology and Middle East studies at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's also taught at Temedican University in Cairo, at Leiden University in Netherlands, other places around the world. He's interested in social movements in the Arab world, and he's written a number of books on this, including this book that I mentioned, Life as Politics, How Ordinary People Changed the Middle East, and it is published by the Stanford University Press. Also, by the way, I mentioned Doug Saunders. He was on the show last week, and if people would like to catch up on that, if that sounds interesting, go to our website, will.illinois.edu. You can listen to that show. A lot of past shows. You can catch up on some you might have missed. And here we are here live, and if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As I said, I made this point, is that you have to be careful in looking at what has happened here over the last few months in a number of countries about making generalizations, because every place is different. And we had two revolutions, literally, where rulers were upset. We have a number of other places where, at least so far, the government has been able to keep a lid on things by using force. We have the case of Libya, which maybe is a special case again altogether, because there it seems like what we have is a true civil war going on there. Is there, though, something that does, in fact, tie all of these cases together?
I think what should think that there must be something, some things that tie these countries and movements together, because it isn't just one or two. There are many of them. So despite the fact that, as you mentioned quite correctly, that there are really quite differences between these countries. There's a big difference, for instance, between Saudi Arabia or Egypt on the one hand and Yemen on the other hand. I mean, the degree of development has been different. The degree of urbanization, literacy, and so forth, they have been quite different. But I think there are certain really structural changes that I think all of these countries have experienced in the past two or three decades, and these changes have generated actors that we see on the streets. First of all, as I mentioned, these countries are rapidly becoming urbanized, and in fact, on the whole, in the region, in the Middle East, over 65% of the people now live in the cities than in the rural areas. There is a growing, of course, literacy. Now over 85% of the people in the region can read and write, and there has been, of course, explosion of the universities, and we have now over 200 universities in the region, which is quite considerable, and of course produces graduates, college-educated people, and who, of course, poured into the labor market. But then the question is whether a labor market is able to absorb them. And I think here comes one of the sort of similarities that many of these countries really share. Not only all of them are authoritarian, but in recent years they have instituted a new economic policy, which has opened up in some way. There has been quite considerable privatization and free marketization, restructuring, downsizing, and so on, which has really led to quite a considerable discontent, because a number of people have lost their jobs. And this generated a very segmented, unequal job market, so that you know, some segment of the educated people are able to enjoy very much on certain economic activities like high tech and those areas which are connected to, you know, international business, and they thrive. Whereas others, I think perhaps the majority, have been excluded from the sort of developmental processes which have been going on, you know, in these societies, and they become really quite discontented. I mean, these are people who have a lot of expectation, a lot of knowledge also about the world, because they are all college-educated people, and they have global dreams. And knowledge about their own deprivation and what is really available. And at the same time, however, economically they are pushed to live the life of the real poor, as I mentioned, in the living, for instance, in the informal sector, housing and working in casual jobs and precarious activities. And they get very, very frustrated, you know, with their position. They are what are called middle class, really poor. So they have middle class dream, but they are actually poor. And I think they have been key, I think, actors in most of these uprising. Of course, this is not a new phenomenon. It has been there for some time, I would say, in late 1980s, early 90s. But the political situation at that period was different. Many of them had been absorbed by the Islamist politics, which dominated the region at the time. But things have changed, and I think we have now a new environment. I claim that we have actually moved into a new sort of phase of post-Islamism, and so it is a new kind of political vision that many of them have, which have been now galvanized in these sort of recent revolutions.
I want to talk, have you talk some more about that, but just to come back to another point, I think about how now going back at least 10 years, maybe 20, people talking about looking then ahead to the future of the region, North Africa and the Middle East. I think a lot of people continued to point to a demographic trend, and that was the what was then and what was expected to be the growing numbers of people who were, say, under 20.
Yes, right.
Young people.
Yes, that's right.
Who were expected to have real expectations.
That's right.
Of a life.
Right.
And that it was going to be a real challenge to their governments to meet those people's expectations.
Right.
And it seems that maybe some of what we're seeing now is in fact the fulfillment of that prediction, that yes, we have significant numbers of people coming up who want to have a life. They want an education, they want a good job, they want to have a family, they want to live a middle class life.
Right.
And that if those expectations are not met, there's going to be trouble.
That's very true. I think it's true that by and large, the region has experienced a so-called youth bulge. In mm-hmm. fact, you know, the Middle Eastern societies have the sort of youngest sort of cohort of population in the world. And it's interestingly, the unemployment among the youth, which is now across the region about 25%, is also the highest in the world. So this is not really coincidence, therefore, that you know, these youngsters who are, you know, increasingly becoming aware, you know, of their own position and aware of, you know, what is available in the world, get obviously very much frustrated. You know, the expression of frustration have been also a problem in the past because there wasn't really a venue through which they could exhibit. It was very depressing, you know, in the late 1990s, early 1990s, among those people who necessarily had not been absorbed by Islamism. Most of them had the sort of dream of, you know, migrating to the West and, you know, founding a new life. And while a lot of them first felt that they were trapped there. And of course, it will be a challenge also for the post-revolutionary regimes. To what extent they will be able to fulfill this incredible rise in the expectations among these very young people. Plus, of course, you know, others too, you know, laborers and the inhabitants of informal communities, villagers, and so forth. So it is really a big challenge. Mm-hmm. More manageable through democratic means, through negotiation and discussion rather than really suppression.
Mm. I want to, come back to the idea of if indeed what we're talking about here, as you argue, is a movement towards a post-Islamic world or post-Islamic politics in this region, what that means. And that it does indeed seem that we've gone from this point where movements that were pushing for political and social change were, I don't want to say exactly that they were motivated by their religious values, but that the movements were really informed by people's religious values. And when they thought about, well, what kind of society do we want to make,
sure,
they wanted their religious values to be embodied, mm-hmm, in that society. And it seems that now, and this again may have something to do with demographics, perhaps, have seen a change so that now we have people, it's not that they're abandoning their religious values, but that somehow the idea that, or the expectations that that will be an Islamic society that will be governed according to Islamic principles, that Islam will really inform the politics, that seems to have changed.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yes, yes. Very true. I think, first of all, I use the term post-Islamist. Post-Islamist. It's true. After the Iranian Islamic Revolution of 1979, Islamism as an ideology and movement became pretty dominant in the region. I think by which I mean those ideologies and movements who want to establish some kind of an Islamic order, mm-hmm, a religious state, you know, Sharia law and moral codes. One important characteristic of these ideologies and movement is that they feel that there is a need to capture the state power. So they need to move into state power. And it is through these state institutions that they can enforce their dictum, or an important sort of doctrinal dictum, which is spreading good and forbidding evil or wrong. So through the Islamic State, therefore, not only they do so, but also they maintain their power. But this has an implication because they constantly emphasize on people's obligations. Islamists feel that they know better the interests of the people than the people themselves. Mm-hmm. And they are the ones who should tell them what to do, what not to do. So people are largely treated as dutiful subjects rather than as rightful citizens. citizens, meaning that not only people have responsibilities and duties, but they also have rights and choices. Now, that's Islamism. And this kind of politics, I think, dominated the region for a long time, for a lot of reasons why it did. But things, I think, have changed, and I think Islamism has, in the course of two decades or so, faced an incredible challenge from within and from without. And it has faced a legitimacy crisis, and through trial and error, they realized that they have not been able to fulfill many expectations of the population that they try to recruit and govern. So therefore, Islamists have tried now to re-envision their sort of religious project, their religious vision, and the consequence have been a move towards post-Islamism, and by which I mean a project that wishes to maintain piety, religiosity, but at the same time mix it with the principle of rights. So they want to mix faith with freedom, Islam and democracy. And they don't see necessarily a discrepancy or contradiction between being Muslim and being Democrat. So I think most of the perhaps protagonists in the current revolutions seems to be of this nature, that they are believers, and they are, most of them are Muslim. Of course, there are non-Muslims, Christians, and non-believers, and non-religious. But I think the majority, however, are believers. And yet, they feel that through this revolution, they can maintain a pious society in their countries, and at the same time institute a democratic government. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, very interesting. An extremely significant development in the politics of the region.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge, and talking this morning with Asif Bayat. He's professor of sociology and Middle East studies at the University of Illinois. He's interested in social movements, and particularly social movements in the Middle East. And questions are welcome. We have a couple, and we have about 10 minutes left. So we'll get right back to the phones here and talk with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested in your opinion as to how much neoliberalism in the United States and in the West has compounded problems in the Middle East with the insistence upon privatization, which seems to have resulted in greater unemployment.
Thank you very much for your question. I think neoliberalism has had, has been a significant player in all these, uprisings. Probably more or less, because in different countries, perhaps the implementation of neoliberal policies have been quite different. But in places like Egypt, which has been one of the protagonists of the implementation of economic reform and structural adjustment, the impact has been quite considerable. And we have seen in the past decade or so growing, of course, privatization, growing unemployment, and, of course, a somewhat growing withdrawal of the state from, the traditional social responsibility and social contract that they have had, for years and after sort of during the post-colonial times since Nasser. I think, and we've seen this in Morocco and also in recent years in Tunisia as well. So I think it has been quite a significant player. And in post-revolutionary times now, there is now an attempt, and there is now new thinking on the part of the activists and, social movements to somewhat modify this new liberal drive in these countries. In particular, last week I was in Egypt, and there is a talk about reinstituting a new sort of social contract. There is a talk about changing, for instance, the labor law, which has been pretty pro-business. So the revolutionaries certainly have taken this issue on board.
Well, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go to somebody else here. We'll go to Champaign County, and this is line two. Hello.
Hi. For a term that isn't used much in the discourse in the U.S., that was exactly my question. My comrade there asked it in advance, so maybe you should expand on what that means. I'm hearing a lot of people in the current administration and other think tanks and stuff talking about how this Arab Spring will, you know, allow for a lot of new growth in the sense of, you know, new commerce and that sort of thing. But it's actually pretty demonstrably that that it was a large part of the problem, that it actually did a lot of damage. And I know apologists for neoliberalism say that it's simply that it was done poorly. The privatization was done corruptly. Well, I mean, who's supporting the outfits that are yes, that are doing the corrupt division of the spoils, or whatever one would like to call it? So I think I appreciate the answer, but I think it needs a little for American discourse. Most people don't know what neoliberalism is, and the fact that Egyptian military, who are, you know, accoladed by chance of we are one with the military, et cetera, et cetera. One of the first things they did was keep the draconian labor sort of situation intact, and that I see that as along with the fact that they didn't actually acknowledge what people were voting for in the elections. That's somewhat reported here.
Well, I mean, I think the perhaps...
Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yes, I think that perhaps the central crux of neoliberalism being this idea that economic individualism or free enterprise is the answer for the development of these nations. And so, that leads to a situation where some people, some groups, some classes benefit enormously, but then what happens to those who are unable to compete? And so that leads to exclusions of, you know, a large number of people. So the idea that state perhaps have some responsibility towards its citizens, that diminishes, you know, under this kind of ideology. And so the strong people become stronger and the weak people become weaker. And I, basically that's very kind of crude, in some way, description of this kind of ideology, which has been developing you know, since the late 1970s, you know, in the West, and it has permeated in many developing countries as well. Now, these revolutions in the Middle East certainly are not socialist revolutions. However, the activists and participants have concerns that somewhat derives from the negative consequences of the so-called economic reform and structural adjustment or new liberal policies. And it is very likely that there might be some modifications of these policies in the future in these countries.
Mm. I want to thank the caller. We have about 5 minutes left. And a little earlier, you were talking about Egypt and the fact that you were just had been back from a visit there just in the last couple of days. And thinking about some of the comments that you made just before we took this caller about the move to a post-Islamist.
Yes.
And I take the difference between Islamist and Islamic.
Yes.
Islamist politics. And I'm thinking about Egypt, particularly some of the things we're thinking now, we're hearing now about the kind of conversation that's going on within the members of the Muslim Brotherhood.
That's right.
This was a group that was officially banned, but also in Egypt before the revolution happened to be in the biggest organized political opposition group, officially banned. Okay. And during the whole process, interestingly enough, also during the whole process of the revolution, they really stood back. I'm sure for a number of reasons they really stood back. But what's interesting now is that within the Brotherhood, there's this discussion going on about what should the direction be. And that there appears to be a very interesting breakdown between the younger ones and the older ones, and a sort of a little intergenerational conversation here about the way things that should go. And I wonder if that's something that you can talk about.
Sure. I think during the revolution, by and large, religious groups opposed it. Religious institutions, rather, I should say, opposed it or initially were reluctant. And that include the Azhar, establishment Islam, shall we say, the official institution of Islam in Egypt. They were not very enthusiastic about the revolution. The church, Coptic church, they were not interested either. Hmm. And the Salafis, they actually opposed. The Salafis are, how shall I put it, pretty strict so-called fundamentalists, but apolitical believers in Egypt, who basically advocated their members not to go into the streets. And Ahwal al-Muslimin, the old guard, the leadership, was reluctant to join the revolution, but their shabab or their youth, however, already were cooperating with the leftists, liberals, democrats, and other political, and basically the youth of 25th of January movement. They were already there, had basically defying their own leadership, and they were active. So, however, when things, you know, unfolded and, you know, mass mobilization took place, of course, Ahwan came in and joined, you know, the revolution. And now it seems that now they are playing an important part in, you know, public debate. Now, of course, the Ahwan had already started, I think, for a decade or so, to have some kind of internal debate about their differences. There has been a major rift. And I think this rift has now become very open because the common enemy is gone, because Mubarak is gone, and everything is now clear. And there is a big discussion within the group. And it seems to me that at least there the group will be divided into three, you know, Ahwan plus two political parties. Already two have been established. And Shabab, or the youth of the Ahwan, think quite differently. In fact, they hold a conference when I was there articulate their position vis-a-vis their leaders, and I participated in the conference. Basically, for instance, they said that Ahwal al-Muslimin, or Muslim Brothers, should stop being underground anymore, should be transparent, should act like an NGO in the sense that they should be accountable to some authorities about what they are doing and what happens to their fundings and things like this. They should be transparent. And especially, they should respect the rights of non-religious and Coptics or Christians, and especially women in public life, and so that women and Coptics too should be, of course, their rights should be recognized to be the heads of the states. So there is a lot of discussion right now going on. But interestingly, the Salafis, who were opposed to the revolution, now they have begun to claim it. And they are also began to, establish a political party and so forth. But the mood is very different. And I think now, as I said, we have now in somewhat post-Islamist mood. I think the vast majority do not necessarily wish to have, I think no one at least claims that there should be something like an Islamic State in Iran. No one, and that includes even the Salafis, right? But I think there will be somewhat a more plural society. There will be a lot of discussion between religious, non-religious, between liberals and Democrats and Christians, Muslims, and so forth. It will be more plural and perhaps more even vibrant.
Hmm. Well, I think there we'll have to leave it with the sure promise that we'll continue to watch, and maybe we'll have some other opportunities for conversation. For the moment, though, two books maybe people might like to look at if they're interested in some of the things we're talking about by our guest, Asif Bayat. You might take a look at his book, Life as Politics, How Ordinary People Changed the Middle East, published by the Stanford University Press, and also Being Young and Muslim, that published by the Oxford University Press. Both of those books came out last year. Asif Bayat is professor of sociology and Middle East studies here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much for being
here. Thank you very much for having me.